Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, setting out into the deep with Saint Anselm and explaining the Courtyard of the Gentiles project. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. At the end of last week, the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome hosted a conference focusing on the figure of Saint Anselm in the context of Europe. But who exactly was Saint Anselm? In an effort to find out more, I turned to a fellow Benedictine, Dom Henry O'Shea, Secretary General to the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, Notker Wolf, and who therefore lives at the College of St. Anselm High on Rome's Aventine Hill, but who's originally from the monastery of Glenstall Abbey in Ireland, and who was also kind enough to come to the radio and sit down with me in our studios here. Let's listen to our conversation. Dom Henry O'Shea, you just told me that by training you were a historian.
Yes.
I can ask you the first question. I'm a little confused. St. Anselm was a Benedictine monk.
Yes.
Considered to be an Italian.
Yes.
Monk, medieval philosopher and theologian who was born in Aosta, which then was within the boundaries of the Kingdom of Burgundy. Yet I think he's best known to the English-speaking world as St. Anselm of Canterbury. There's a bit of a leap there. From Aosta to Canterbury. What did he do? Go hopping around all the various monasteries in Europe?
Yes. Well, I think the first thing we've got to be aware of is that modern boundaries, of course, are relatively recent. The Burgundy you're talking about was much bigger than the Burgundy that we would know today.
It
was a kingdom. In its own right, and very important, in fact. One of the main titles, for example, of the Habsburgs later on was actually Duke of Burgundy. And it still features in the coats of arms, if you're interested in those things. But the important thing is that you're talking about somebody who, while being very careful not to transfer modern categories of European, etc., at the same time, it is true that at that stage there was a fairly cosmopolitan society. That's the first thing. The second thing, of course, about Anselm is that one of the main reasons he left home was because of an unsatisfactory relationship with his father.
He came from an aristocratic family.
His father clearly wasn't terribly keen on his joining the monastery, which he wanted to do at the age of 15. So he went then to Normandy. Now, I suppose, again, transferring modern ideas to those days, this was one of the places where careers were being made at the time. They were themselves, Normandy, as the name would suggest, were themselves, as it were, two or three centuries on from their own invasion, and we're now talking about the time running up to the Norman invasion of England. So it was a good place to be.
Anselm was born in 1033.
1033, exactly. So 30 years before.
30 years before 1066.
And all that, yes. And so I think, of course, the main attraction seems to have been that Lanfranc, who also came from that part of Burgundy, was the prior of Bec at the time, a monastery which in recent times has come to exist again. And it was also, I think, if we're to believe what we're told by the various lives of Anselm, etc., he was also attracted by the intellectual status of Lanfranc. It's normal today to think of Benedictines as learned. That, in fact, really comes from a development in the 17th century rather than before that. But nevertheless, it's true in this case that Bec was the centre of learning, particularly was the centre of what we might call the revival of learning after the so-called Dark Ages, which were never as dark as we were led to believe. But nevertheless,
the time of St. Bede and the Venerable.
Well, that was slightly earlier, yes, of course. And Anselm, I suppose, if he was thinking historically, though we don't know whether he did or not.
He wrote about Bede, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and he would probably have seen himself then in that tradition of monastic learning, which is why, of course, he's so interesting for many Benedictines today as well. It's very interesting for me, coming as I do from Ireland. I don't normally think of St. Anselm primarily as St. Anselm of Canterbury at all. I think of him primarily as Anselm of Beck, not of Aosta, not of Cantry, but of Beck. Because for us, if you were to take Anselm as a model, one of the most interesting things for us is his time as prior of Beck, where he really started what was in effect, though not a name, a university. It's probably better to use the German word Hochschule.
Which means?
Centre of learning, high school, basically, really.
You mentioned his appeal to you today as a monk, I imagine, as
yes.
a Benedictine monk,
yes.
as
yes.
Dom Henry. But what is his appeal, do you think, to the rest of the world, the Catholic world, the Anglicans and the Lutherans as well?
I think probably the most important thing is the combination of genuine sanctity with intellectual rigour and curiosity. Because for many people, there's a great tendency, not just today, but in previous centuries as well, to imagine that to embrace the religious life is also to embrace a certain form of brain death. And that is not at all true. And the great attraction of Anselm is that he combines a very, very strong faith with strong sense of intellectual inquiry and also a strong sense of intellectual rigour. He wrote, of course, highly interesting things, and the questions he talked about both in theology and in philosophy are absolutely fascinating for us today. It doesn't necessarily mean that we automatically agree with everything he said, because in many ways the debate has moved on, as it were. But the very fact that the debate itself should have taken place at all is fascinating. And the issues he discussed are still issues for today. The existence of God, the role of individual faith, the appropriation of the teaching of the Church, the appropriation of the teaching of the Bible, etc. Those are all as acute issues today as they were 1,000 years ago.
His symbol in hagiography, however you pronounce that word, is the ship.
Yes.
It represents the spiritual independence of the Church, no?
Not just that. I'm very interested in heraldry. though interestingly, his coat of arms is not the ship, but it's used as his attribute as a saint. What it really is the idea of set out into the deep. Set out into the deep for various things. Set out into the deep as a pastor, as a fisherman, but also set out into the deep of the possible dangers of exploration and inquiry. That's also terribly important. So it's a very happy symbol, which I would have no difficulty in identifying.
Yet he was caught between being a contemplative monk and a savvy politician, in a sense, wasn't he?
Of course, but that was inevitable in those times, given the political, we use the word now, position of the Archbishop of Canterbury, or even an Abbot of Beck. Because remember, of course, that these people were also important feudal lords. And as feudal lords, of course, that was the origin of the dispute then between the Pope and the Emperor, between the King and the Archbishop, about the precise role of both. The King as the temporal lord who depended on the support of his feudal lords in battle, for example, an Archbishop had to provide the service of so many knights, etc., etc., or if he couldn't do that, he had to provide money. So inevitably, an Archbishop, a prelate of any kind, of any importance, would be caught up in the political circumstances of the day. And of course, remember, at this time you're also dealing in the period immediately during and after the Gregorian reforms. So this reassertion of the, or probably assertion is a better word than reassertion, of the temporal as well as the spiritual power of the papacy and the Church generally. What you were really at a period where we're working out what in subsequent centuries was to become the current models both of the political society and of the ecclesiastical society. We tend, of course, today to make this absolute distinction between church and state. That's a relatively modern development, of which this, of course, is the beginning. There are other civilizations and other cultures that just don't have that concept, even today.
Even the fact of St. Anselm writing to people like kings and queens, like Matilda of England, that gives you the sense of the role of the church in society. It transpires in Pius X's encyclical Communium Rerum, which was published, well, exactly 100 years ago,
exactly,
to mark
eight
centuries since Anselm's death. It seems incredible that a pope would write an encyclical on a figure like Anselm today. I mean, you wouldn't think of Benedict today writing an encyclical on St. Anselm, would you?
Probably not an encyclical, but he certainly wrote a letter recently, because he's a very important person for the present Holy Father, precisely because he emphasised, St. Anselm, that is, emphasised the importance of reason, the importance of intelligence, the importance of intelligent inquiry, the possibility of uniting that with faith. The important thing, of course, for Anselm, as it is also for the present Holy Father, we start off in a context of faith. And all our theologizing, all our philosophizing is done in that context of faith. It doesn't mean, of course, that we don't apply the necessarily rigorous intellectual standards. Of course, we have to do that. But it's not at all unusual. Also, of course, I don't know how encyclicals come to be, but certainly at the time the Benedictines were in the course of a great revival at the beginning of the 20th century. And Pius X was a great supporter of, for example, the College of Sant'Anselmo in Rome, which was not called Sant'Anselmo just for nothing. It was also, of course, because we were Benedictines, Anselm was a Benedictine, but also because the College of Sant'Anselmo had already been established in the 17th century, St. Anselm being the great model theologian, intellectual saint, etc. The title was transferred then at the end of the 19th century to this new Benedictine confederation, which had been set up by Pope Leo XIII. To try to unify the Benedictines, he wasn't totally successful in that, but what he was very successful in was establishing the College of St. Anselmo as a centre of theology, philosophy, intellectual inquiry and training for Benedictines. And I think they may have had something to do in encouraging Pius X to write his encyclical, because, of course, he talks about all of that, the importance of faith, reason.
What do you think is the Benedictine hallmark of St. Anselm, at a personal level?
Well, for us, certainly his approach to the scriptures, for example, that's still very much in the monastic, what we now regard as the monastic tradition. There's been a huge amount of work done, particularly in the last 100 years, on the monastic use of the scriptures as a source of theology. It is also true that Anselm has already started to move from a purely scripture-based theology to, he's called, for example, the first of the scholastics. Now, I don't know how accurate that is as a designation. But for us Benedictines, at least for this particular Benedictine, the exciting thing is that he manages to preserve a dependence on the traditional sources of revelation, the scriptures, traditional both as a source of theology but also as a source of personal meditation, personal holiness, and at the same time starts what we would regard as a very modern intellectual appropriation of those sources as well. And that is for me. And that's why, of course, we have him as our patron in St. Anselmo, not just in St. Anselmo. And then we use, it's fashionable, of course, to use certain cliches, for example, faith seeking understanding, etc., etc. But the fact that they're cliches doesn't mean that they're not true. And I certainly find that because it's an enormous challenge all the time. As I was saying earlier on, joining the monastery does not bring with it brain death. And St. Benedict speaks, for example, in the Rule about expansion of the heart. And I think that's a hugely important concept, that the heart seen as the whole person, not just an emotional thing, but also an intellectual thing. That if we think in terms of an expanding context all the time, we've got an expanding context of inquiry, an expanding context of love, and an expanding context of prayer. All these things are contained in that, and that is what I would see. Now, it could be, it's possible that I may be reading into St. Anselm. We always tend to interpret people in the light of our own exigencies. But I think at the same time, it's true that he can be taken as a model for these things. I think we sometimes today fall into the trap of thinking that saints must necessarily be nice people. Remember again, of course, one is a saint because of the triumph of grace in one, not because of one's own activities or one's own personality necessarily. So for that reason, when you were asking earlier on there about how you can have a savvy politician and a monk and contemplative at the same time, there may be certain presenting contradictions, but at the same time, if you make allowance for the operation, for the economy of grace in each individual, it's possible to combine these things. I don't know whether St. Anselm was a nice person. He certainly seems to be a holy person.
And warm thanks there go to Benedictine, Dom Henry O'Shea, currently Secretary General to the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, and who's originally from Glenstall Abbey in Ireland. And now moving on in the broadcast, we join a parish priest, north of Liverpool, who, when I first met him, was an official at the Pontifical Council for Culture. You may have guessed, he's Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. So, Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, you're now a parish priest in Blundell Sands, Liverpool, but you're still in touch with the council that you used to work for when you were here in Rome, which is the Pontifical Council for Culture, which is now headed by Archbishop Gianfranco Ravasi, who's ideated a project which has the wonderful name of the Courtyard of the Gentiles. Why is it called the Courtyard of the Gentiles?
It refers to part of the temple. And the Pope used this expression just before Christmas in 2009 when he was addressing people of the Roman Curia. And he said, we should really have a place that we can call the courtyards of the Gentiles.
La Chiesa dovrebbe anche oggi aprire una sorta di cortile dei gentili.
I think that today, too, the Church should open a sort of court of the Gentiles in which people might in some way latch on to God without knowing him and before gaining access to his mystery, at whose service the inner life of the Church stands.
He didn't mean a physical place, he meant some method of encountering people who feel that religion is something alien to them, but they're willing to engage in serious dialogue with believers. So the Courtyard of the Gentiles is an area in the church's life where people who want to talk to believers are welcome. They feel they're welcome, they'll be taken seriously, and there'll be a serious, high-level discussion, and which will take many forms, on the way non-believers can speak to believers and vice versa in a productive way.
Do non-believers want to speak to believers?
Well, I think so. The recent visit of the Pope to England changed quite a few people's minds, because when they saw the man and heard what he had to say and saw how he presented his ideas, heard his ideas, they had to say to themselves, well, we think we got this wrong. A lot didn't, don't get me wrong. A lot still think they'll never agree with the Pope or his ideas or his church or whatever. But many people, I think, were quite engaged by his way of presenting what he believes. And also, when I was working at the council, I took it upon myself to write reports every time we issued our quarterly magazine on atheist and humanist organisations. But I never put a judgment in there. I just said that we knew what was going on. And eventually, the leaders of some of these atheist and humanist movements actually came to see who was writing this stuff, who was keeping an eye on them but not judging them. And it really was a door that opened wide, quite surprisingly. So I think there is a desire to talk beyond the invective you sometimes hear and the aggressive rhetoric that can be on both sides, I have to admit. Beyond that, you often get people who really are keen to engage and know more of the other side's point of view.
Of course, maybe our listeners are not aware of this, but the Pontifical Council for Culture grew out of a council which was dedicated to non-believers. Is that correct?
Yeah, at the end of the Second Vatican Council, there was an organism there for dialogue with other Christians. There was one for dialogue with people of other religions. And there was one, finally, for dialogue with people of no faith, the Secretariat for Non-Believers, which eventually became, in the terminology of the Roman Curia, the Pontifical Council for Dialogue with Non-Believers. And eventually that was absorbed into a newer council called the Pontifical Council for Culture. So the work has always been there, ever since the mid-60s.
So getting back to this new project, it's getting off the ground now. And it has a general theme, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think what the Pope said was he'd like to meet people for whom religion is something alien, for whom God is unknown, and who, in any case, don't want to be simply without God, but to approach God at least as someone they don't know. And I think what he probably meant was people who are in some way, even a minute way, fascinated by the people they know who believe and obviously live and get energy and strength, apart from comfort and all those other things that people normally think of religion, but people who even think out of their faith, you know, for whom their faith is really part of the impulse for daily life.
Given this, as you mentioned, this Courtyard of the Gentiles is not a physical space. It can move around quite easily. That's what it's going to do, isn't it?
Yeah,
in different areas.
I suppose maybe a modern word for it, and a contemporary word, might be the interface between believers and non-believers. And of course, that's everywhere in the world where there are believers and non-believers who bump into each other in one way or another. The first event is going to be in a place that has been chosen because of its symbolic value. That's Paris. I suppose those who are old enough to remember will think back to the days of the late 1960s when the university and the Left Bank and the Boulevard Saint-Michel were the place for thinkers to meet and to, you know, to think out of the box, to think new, think of a new society, new ethics. Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, many, many other well-known thinkers. So they'll be meeting in UNESCO, whose whole purpose is to recognise that wars start in the mind and wars can be finished in the mind. They'll be meeting at the Sorbonne, very high-level intellectual place. And the
university.
Yeah, and the Catholic Institute of Paris. Three different places for people of great minds to meet specifically on the subject of non-belief. And there will be a dramatic event, really, on the threshold of Notre Dame Cathedral, at the end of which people will be invited to come into the cathedral. There'll be no pressure on anybody to pray, but non-believers will be invited to come in and think their own thoughts, be there simply, and the Taizé community will provide 45 minutes of meditative music and prayer. As I say, no one is being forced to pray, but people being asked to be together in a sacred space, as well as the external space they've already shared time in. I suppose the idea really is to give space and time for discussion, but not just for discussion, also for taking each other seriously, hearing each other, rather than talking about each other, talking to each other, which is always, you know, it's always a move forward.
Surely you have to have a theme to talk about, some sort of specific theme, no?
Well, I think in the Catholic Institute in Paris, they were talking about ethics and finance, law and various cultural points of view, and also art, worship and culture. In the Sorbonne, it'll be more a question of recognising what's happened in France, but more broadly elsewhere. Since the Enlightenment, France would be known as the cradle of the Enlightenment, really, although much of it grew in eventually in Germany and England and America, North America. So there are particular themes for particular places. I think in one of the planned events, probably the one in Sweden, where the Swedish Academy is working with the Pontifical Council for Culture, that's the partner there, I think they're going to have a session of interviews and discussions which eventually will lead into people together writing a play, which they'll then perform.
You mean believers and non-believers writing together?
Yes, yeah. And the idea is to be as creative as possible in as many different fields of creativity as possible, in as many different places as possible. There's also been contact with an institute in Albania, so that people who've lived under militant and state-sponsored atheism may now, after the restrictions have gone, begin to discuss a subject that really was taboo for many, many years. And then the idea is to move out gradually. I think Sweden is a way into the Nordic countries. It is a known fact that Norway, for example, has more humanist organisations than anywhere else in Europe. And I think it's probably outstripped only by the United States because of its size, and India, which has got a phenomenal number of organisations against religion because there's such a multiplicity of religions in India. As yet, I don't think there's any plan for the Courtyard of Gentiles to go that far, but it will hopefully do so. And one of my tasks that I've just been given is to try and find ways into universities, major universities in England and Wales, so that we can have high-level encounters, meetings, I suppose we'd say in English, meetings between academics who are for and against religion. People who take each other seriously, by no means do they need to agree. Probably much better if they disagree, to create a very lively and productive debate.
So what starts in Europe is intended to move across the world in different continents, because we are a universal church, aren't we?
Yeah, well, the question is, we start where we have contacts, good contacts, and then build up more contacts. And I think from the few reactions I've seen already, there is interest in this project, but it's just that it hasn't been articulated, certainly not in English, very clearly up to now. So the more it's known, I think the more interest it will arouse. And I do think it'll spread very quickly. I know that at the forthcoming plenary meeting of the Pontifical Council for Culture, an American contact will be asked, what are the possibilities in the university where he works? So, you know, there is a little push, gentle, but, firm attempt to move as far away as we can.
A gentle push for the Courtyard of the Gentiles, then.
Yes, yeah, gentle Gentiles. I may not sound very excited in my voice, but I really am happy, because when I worked at the council, it was very clear that it was necessary to continue the dialogue, but I'm delighted that there's a more creative approach now come along. We're being asked to be as creative as possible and to engage as many creative minds as we can meet and interest in the project. So I think it can only do good. And a lot of good. It might take time, but it will work.
And our thanks there go to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, currently parish priest of St Joseph's, Blundellsands, north of Liverpool in England. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. Laudetur Jesus Christus.